Hello, and welcome to today's reading from the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for today, Friday, November the 10th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. I'll start with the Mason City Globe Gazette, and here's the first story entitled, Tide of Refugees Surges. Israel agrees to daily pauses to allow people to flee hotspots. This is written by Wafa Sharafa, Bassem Marouk, and Jack Jeffrey of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. Crowds of Palestinian families stretching as far as the eye could see walked out of Gaza City and surrounding areas towards the south Thursday to escape Israeli airstrikes and ground troops battling Hamas militants in dense urban neighborhoods. Others joined tens of thousands taking shelter at the city's biggest hospital, not far from the fighting. Gaza's largest city is the focus of Israel's campaign to crush Hamas following its deadly October 7th incursion, and the Israeli military claims Hamas's main command center is located in and under the Shifa hospital complex. The militant group and hospital staff deny that, saying the military is creating a pretext to strike it. Growing numbers of people are living in and around the hospital complex, hoping it will be safer than their homes or UN shelters in the north, several of which have been hit repeatedly. Israeli troops were about 2 miles from the hospital, its director said. The accelerating exodus to the south came as Israel agreed to hold daily four-hour humanitarian pauses and to open a second route for people to flee the north, the White House said. The scope of the pauses was not immediately clear. The agreement came as Western and Arab officials gathered in Paris on Thursday to discuss ways of providing more aid to civilians in Gaza. Separately, mediators worked on a possible deal for a 3-day ceasefire in exchange for the release of about a dozen hostages held by Hamas, according to two Egyptian officials, a United Nations official, and a Western diplomat. Israeli ground forces battled near Gaza's largest hospital, Shifa. Conditions for tens of thousands of people sheltering there have become catastrophic, said Wafa Abu Hajjaj, a Palestinian journalist at the hospital. She, as well as several people who left the hospital to go south, said families are sleeping in hospital rooms, emergency rooms, surgical theaters, the maternity ward, or on the streets outside. Daily food distributions helped a tiny number of for a time, but there has been no bread for the past 4 days, they said. Water is scarce and usually polluted, and few people can bathe. Still, more families are arriving, believing it is safer than fleeing to the south, where airstrikes also continue, though some started to leave because of nearby missile strikes and the sound of clashes between Israeli forces and Hamas fighters, Abu Hajjaj said. The hospital is overwhelmed with daily waves of wounded from airstrikes, while medical supplies are running low and electricity shut off in many wards. The UN delivered 2 truckloads of supplies Wednesday night, the second delivery since the war began, enough to last a few hours, the director said. The conditions here are disastrous in every sense of the word, the director, Mohammed Abu Salmiya, told the Associated Press on Thursday. We're short on medicine and equipment, and the doctors and nurses are exhausted. We're unable to do much for the patients. More than two-thirds of Gaza's population of 2.3 million fled their homes since the war began, with hundreds of thousands heeding Israeli orders to flee to the southern part of the enclave. The conditions there are also dire. Israel continues to strike what it says are militant targets in the south, often crushing homes with families inside. Aid deliveries into Gaza from Egypt have reached an average of 100 trucks a day, the U.S. humanitarian envoy for the war, David Satterfield, said Thursday. Relief workers say that is still far below what is needed. A month of relentless bombardment in Gaza since the Hamas attack has killed more than 10,800 Palestinians, nearly two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry in the Hamas-run territory. More than 2,300 others are believed to have been buried by strikes that in some cases have demolished entire city blocks. More than 1,400 people died in Israel since the start of the war, most of them civilians killed by Hamas militants during their initial incursion, officials say. Israel says 32 of its soldiers have been killed in Gaza since the ground offensive began. A drone exploded in the yard of a house in Israel's Red Sea city of Eilat, causing no injuries, and a long-range surface-to-surface missile whose source was under investigation was intercepted before entering Israeli airspace, the military said. The other story on the front page of the Globe Gazette this morning is entitled Abortion Poised to Shape 2024 Elections Nationwide. Democrats see issue as springboard after big wins in GOP strongholds. It's written by Michelle L. Price and Christine Fernando of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. Voters threw their support behind abortion rights in Ohio, Virginia, and elsewhere as Democrats look to springboard off those wins by using the issue to drive turnout and shape next year's races for the White House, Congress, and other elections. Ohio offered the clearest snapshot on Tuesday of the issue's salience, more than a year after the U.S. Supreme Court ended the nationwide right to abortion. Voters in the increasingly Republican-leaning state resoundingly approved an amendment to the state constitution to protect abortion access. Democrats also harnessed the issue in Virginia, riding it to retake control of the legislature, and in Kentucky, giving Democratic Governor Andy Beshear a second term after he made abortion rights central to his campaign in the deeply Republican state. Election night was an energizing moment for Democrats hoping abortion rights will pull voters to the polls in the 2024 presidential election. The campaigning and results for the amendment in Ohio, the only state with an abortion question on the ballot this year, is a precursor to similar ballot measures expected to be put to a vote in several states next year. That includes Arizona and Nevada, which play pivotal roles in the White House race. Abortion will also sit at the center of a slate of state Supreme Court races in 2024. For the anti-abortion movement, the latest post-Roe defeat came after its scattershot messaging struggled to win over voters in a state that has become a testing ground. The scope of the victory for abortion access in Ohio suggests that a significant number of Republicans voted in favor of the amendment, signaling deep divisions in the party over their next steps. Elizabeth Smith, director of state policy and advocacy at the Center for Reproductive Rights, said the anti-abortion movement is on their heels after turning to misinformation and fear-mongering in Ohio in a losing cause. It's become clear that the majority of Americans support abortion rights and want to see abortion remain legal and accessible, and the anti-abortion side knows that, Smith said. According to AP Votecast, a nationwide survey of more than 94,000 voters, 63% of voters in the 2022 midterm elections said abortion should be legal in most or all cases. About one-third of voters said it should be legal in most or all cases. Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the anti-abortion group SBA Pro-Life America, said Ohio's results serve as a warning sign for the GOP heading into 2024 and proved this is not a formula for success. The true lesson from last night's loss is that Democrats are going to make abortion front and center throughout 2024 campaigns, Dannenfelser said in a statement. The GOP consultant class needs to wake up. Candidates must put money and messaging toward countering the Democrats' attacks, or they will lose every time. Anti-abortion groups said the outcome was fueled by millions in campaign donations that abortion rights supporters poured into the Ohio race, including large donations from out-of-state groups. The American Civil Liberties Union, which advocates for abortion rights, spent more than $9 million on races in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia this year, with over $6 million of that going to Ohio, said the group's chief political and advocacy officer, Deirdre Schiffling. The messaging problem for anti-abortion groups goes deeper than their loss in Ohio. In Virginia, Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin tried to rally voters behind GOP legislative candidates by staking out what he and other Republicans felt was middle ground approach, a proposal to ban abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy with exceptions for rape, incest, and situations where the mother's life was at risk. Many GOP candidates in swing districts publicly supported the proposal. It didn't seem to help. Democrats questioned whether Youngkin and Republicans would go further if they ended up controlling the governor's office and the legislature. The governor thought he was going to give a playbook to Republicans, but he actually gave a playbook to Democrats on how to help voters connect the dots between candidates and their abortion policies, said Mini Timuraju, president and CEO of Reproductive Freedom for All, formerly known as NARAL Pro-Choice America. Democrats have made clear they plan to make the issue central in races for the presidency and down the ballot next year. In a fresh sign of the administration trying to link its electoral prospects to the results, Vice President Kamala Harris made a rare appearance before reporters on the White House driveway Wednesday and said, "It was a good night, and the president and I obviously have a lot of work to do to earn our reelection, but I'm confident we're going to win." In the Republican presidential primary, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who signed a 6-week ban in his state, have said they would support a national abortion ban at 15 weeks. Other candidates have been vaguer on their answers. Former President Donald Trump, who nominated 3 Supreme Court justices who helped overturn Roe v. Wade, has refused to say whether he would sign a national ban, and he has warned the issue can be politically difficult to campaign on. Trump has said he could live with the procedure being banned by individual states or nationwide through federal action. Man receives the first eye transplant plus a new face is the title of our next article, and it's written by Lauren Neergaard of the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. Surgeons have performed the world's first transplant of an entire human eye, an extraordinary addition to a face transplant, though it's far too soon to know if the man will ever see through his new left eye. An accident with high-voltage power lines destroyed most of Aaron James's face and one eye. His right eye still works, but surgeons at NYU Langone Health hoped replacing the missing one would yield better cosmetic results for his new face by supporting the transplanted eye socket and lid. The NYU team announced Thursday that so far it's doing just that. James is recovering well from the dual transplant last May, and the donated eye looks remarkably healthy. "It feels good. I still don't have any movement in it yet. My eyelid, I can't blink yet. But I'm getting sensation now," James told the Associated Press as doctors examined his progress recently. "You got to start somewhere. There's got to be a first person somewhere," added James, age 46, of Hot Springs, Arkansas. "Maybe you'll learn something from it that will help the next person." Today, transplants of the cornea, the clear tissue in front of the eye, are common to treat certain types of vision loss. But transplanting the whole eye, the eyeball, its blood supply, and the critical optic nerve that must connect it to the brain is considered a moonshot in the quest to cure blindness. Whatever happens next, James's surgery offers scientists an unprecedented window into how the human eye tries to heal. "We're not claiming that we are going to restore sight," said Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez, NYU's plastic surgery chief who led the transplant, "but there's no doubt in my mind we are one step closer." Some specialists feared the eye would quickly shrivel like a raisin. Instead, when Rodriguez propped open James's left eyelid last month, the donated hazel-colored eye was as plump and full of fluid as his own blue eye. Doctors see good blood flow and no sign of rejection. Researchers have begun analyzing scans of James's brain that detected some puzzling signals from that all-important but injured optic nerve. One scientist who has long studied how to make eye transplants a reality called the surgery exciting. "It's an amazing validation of animal experiments that have kept transplanted eyes alive," said Dr. Jeffrey Goldberg, chair of ophthalmology at Stanford University. "The hurdle is how to regrow the optic nerve, though animal studies are making strides," Goldberg added. He praised the NYU team's audacity and even aiming for optic nerve repair and hopes the transplant will spur more research. "We're really on the precipice of being able to do this," Goldberg said. James was working for a power line company in June of 2021 when he was shocked by a live wire. He nearly died. Ultimately, he lost his left arm, requiring a prosthetic. His damaged left eye was so painful it had to be removed. Reconstructive surgeries couldn't repair extensive facial injuries, including his missing nose and lips. James pushed through physical therapy until he was strong enough to escort his daughter Allie to a high school homecoming ceremony, wearing a face mask and eye patch. Still, he required breathing and feeding tubes and longed to smell, taste, and eat solid food again. In his mind and in his heart, it's him. So I don't care that, you know, he didn't have a nose, but I did care that it bothered him, said his wife Megan James. Face transplants remain rare and risky. James's is only the 19th in the U.S., the fifth Rodriguez has performed. The eye experiment added even more complexity. But James figured he'd be no worse off if the donated eye failed. 3 months after James was placed on the national transplant waiting list, a matching donor was found. Kidneys, a liver, and pancreas from the donor, a man in his 30s, saved three other people. During James's 21-hour operation, surgeons added another experimental twist. When they spliced together the donated optic nerve to what remained of James's original, they injected special stem cells from the donor in hopes of spurring its repair. Last month, tingles heralded healing facial nerves. James can't yet open the eyelid and wears a patch to protect it. But as Rodriguez pushed on the closed eye, James felt sensation, though on his nose rather than his eyelid, presumably until slow-growing nerves get reoriented. The surgeon also detected subtle movements beginning in muscles around the eye. Then came a closer look. NYU ophthalmologist Dr. Vidae Dedanian ran a battery of tests. She found expected damage in the light-sensing retina in the back of the eye, but she said it appears to have enough special cells called photoreceptors to do the job of converting light to electrical signals, one step in creating vision. Normally, the optic nerve then would send those signals to the brain to be interpreted. James's optic nerve clearly hasn't healed, yet when light was flashed into the donated eye during an MRI, the scan recorded some sort of brain signaling. That both excited and baffled researchers, though it wasn't the right type for vision and may simply be a fluke, cautioned Dr. Stephen Galletta, NYU's neurology chair. Only time and more study may tell. Still, the surgery marks a technical tour de force, said Dr. David Clausen, chief medical officer of the United Network for Organ Sharing, which runs the nation's transplant system. You can learn a tremendous amount from a single transplant that could propel the field. As for James, we're just taking it one day at a time, he said. Here's some brief articles from around the nation. Trial opens in attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband. Dateline is San Francisco. The man accused of bludgeoning then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband with a hammer was caught up in conspiracies when he broke into her San Francisco home last year, his defense attorney said as his trial opened Thursday. The attack on then-82-year-old Paul Pelosi on October 28, 2022, sent shockwaves through the political world. David DePape pleaded not guilty to attempted kidnapping of a federal official and assault on the immediate family member of a federal official with intent to retaliate against the official for performance of their duties. Defense attorney Jody Linker said Thursday she will argue that DePape was not trying to stop Nancy Pelosi from engaging in her official duties, but believed he was taking action to stop corruption and the abuse of children by politicians and actors. Next, judge upholds approval for Alaska oil project. This comes from Juneau, Alaska. A federal judge on Thursday upheld the Biden administration's approval of the massive Willow oil drilling project on Alaska's remote North Slope, a decision that environmental groups swiftly vowed to fight. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason rejected requests by a grassroots Inuit group and environmentalists to vacate the project approval and dismissed their claims against Willow, which is the federally designated National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. The company behind the project, ConocoPhillips Alaska, has the right to develop its leases in the reserve, subject to reasonable restrictions and mitigation measures imposed by the federal government, Gleason wrote. The project's approval drew the ire of environmentalists who accused the president of backpedaling on his pledge to combat climate change. The groups that sued raised concerns about planet warming, greenhouse gas emissions from Willow. From Mississippi, people in Hinds County, Mississippi's largest county, demanded answers about why some polling places ran out of ballots and voters had to wait for more Tuesday when the state decided its most competitive governor's race in a generation. Apple agreed Thursday to pay $25 million to settle allegations that it engaged in discriminatory hiring practices in the years 2018 and 2019, resolving a Department of Justice investigation. Donald Trump's lawyers were thwarted Thursday in a long-shot bid to put an end to the New York civil fraud trial threatening the former president's real estate empire. The judge indicated the trial would go on as scheduled Monday. Election threats. Authorities hunted Thursday for whoever sent suspicious letters, including some containing fentanyl, to elections officials in at least five states this week, delaying ballot counting in some races. Inflation. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell suggested Thursday the Fed is in no hurry to further raise its benchmark interest rates, but did not rule out another hike to help reduce inflation to the Fed's 2% target level. And Ukraine war. A Russian missile strike on the Ukrainian port of Odessa hit a Liberian-flagged freighter, killing a port worker and wounding another, as well as three Philippine citizens on the ship Ukraine's military said Thursday. Now we'll turn to sports, and the top story there is Bears top Panthers to boost their own shot at number one pick. This comes from the Associated Press and the Dateline in Chicago. Donata Foreman ran for a touchdown, and the Chicago Bears boosted their shot at the top pick in the draft, beating the Carolina Panthers 16-13 on Thursday night. The primetime matchup between teams among the bottom five in the NFL delivered about as much drama as expected, but Chicago made enough plays to come away with the victory. The Bears also boosted their chances at the number one pick because they have Carolina's first rounder in 2024. They acquired the pick along with DJ Moore last March for the top selection this year. The Panthers are tied with Arizona for the worst record in the NFL at 1 win and 8 losses. Foreman gave the Bears a 16-10 lead in the third quarter with a 4-yard run. Chicago was clinging to a 3-point lead with 1 minute 40 seconds remaining when Carolina's Eddie Pinheiro attempted a 59-yard field goal. The ball landed well short. Moore caught 5 passes for 58 yards against his former team. Rookie Tyson Bagent threw for 162 yards in his fourth straight start with Justin Fields sidelined because of a dislocated right thumb. The undrafted rookie from Division II Shepherd University didn't see open receivers at times and completed 20 of 33 passes after throwing 3 interceptions and losing a fumble last week in a loss at New Orleans. Carolina's Emir Smith Marset returned to punt 79 yards for a touchdown in the first quarter, but Bryce Young, coming off his worst game as a pro, had another rough outing. The number one draft pick this year, he was 21 of 38 for 185 yards with 68.4 rating after throwing 3 interceptions and having 2 returned for scores in a loss to Indianapolis. Adam Thielen caught 6 passes for 42 yards, and the Panthers fell to 0-5 on the road. The Bears grabbed a 16-10 lead midway through the third on a 4-yard run by Foreman, who spent last season with Carolina, to cap a 38-yard drive after pinning the Panthers deep in their own territory. Chicago opted not to try a 2-point conversion to go up by 7. Carolina got a big opportunity late in the third, taking over at the Chicago 40 after Trenton Gill shanked a punt. The Panthers got pushed back 20 yards to start the drive because of back-to-back penalties, then got to the 20 before Pinheiro kicked a field goal to make it a 3-point game early in the fourth. The Panthers led 10-9 at halftime, even though the Bears outgained them 205 yards to 97. Chicago ran 42 plays but settled for 3 field goals by Cairo Santos. Smith Marset, who played part of last season in Chicago, gave the Panthers a 7-0 lead in the first quarter when he returned to punt 79 yards for a touchdown. He broke a tackle by Josh Blackwell, cut through the middle, and used a hesitation move to get past punter Trenton Gill for his first career TD return. Chicago answered with a 54-yard field goal by Santos. Former Bear Pinheiro kicked a 33-yarder early in the second quarter to make it a 7-point game. Santos booted two more field goals, hitting a 36-yarder with just over 3 minutes left and a 39-yarder as time expired to make it a one-point game. Here's the men's college basketball top 25 roundup. Number 4 Michigan State rebounds, drops Southern Indiana. Tyson Walker scored 14 points as number 4 Michigan State bounced back from a surprising loss in its season opener to beat Southern Indiana 74-51 on Thursday night. Matty Sissoko had 11 points and 10 rebounds for the Spartans, who began the season with a loss to James Madison in overtime. The Screaming Eagles missed 17 of their first 18 shots and trailed 37-14 at halftime. They were much more competitive early in the second half, going on a 12-0 run to cut the deficit to 15 points. Michigan State responded by making 5 of 6 shots to take a 22-point lead and coasted to a much-needed victory less than a week before facing number 2 Duke. Jaden Akins scored 13 points, looking more like the playmaker Coach Tom Izzo needs him to be after he was 2 of 10 with 4 points in the opener. Malik Hall added 12 points for the Spartans. At number 20, Baylor, 96, John Brown, 70. Langston Love matched his career high with 20 points. Ray J. Dennis scored 16 points with 8 assists, and Baylor won its home opener over NAIA squad John Brown. Jaden Nunn added 15 points for the Bears, who played the midday game only about 37 hours after finishing their season-opening win over Auburn in South Dakota. Drew Miller had 19 points with 5 three-pointers and led John Brown. Malachi Reeves added 17 points while making all 7 of his field goal attempts. Number 21, USC, 85, Cal State Bakersfield, 59. Isaiah Collier scored 19 points. Ozaiah Sellers added a career-high 16, and Southern California routed Cal State Bakersfield in the Trojans' home opener. And number 23, St. Mary's, 72, New Mexico, 58. Sophomore guard Aiden Mahaney matched his career high with 25 points to lead the Gales past the visiting Lobos. Here's the results of Thursday night's NBA games. Indiana Pacers defeated the Milwaukee Bucks 126-124, and the Atlanta Hawks beat the Orlando Magic 120-119. In the NHL, the Rangers beat the Wild 4-1. The Sharks beat the Oilers 3-2. Blackhawks 5, a Lightning 3. The Canadiens 3, Red Wings 2. That game went into overtime. The Canucks beat the Senators 5-2. The Dallas Stars beat the Columbus Blue Jackets 5-2. St. Louis Blues beat the Arizona Coyotes 2-1. The Winnipeg Jets beat the Nashville Predators 6-3. And the Seattle Kraken defeated the Colorado Avalanche 4-3. And that's about all the time we have for readings from the Mason City Globe Gazette today. A reminder that you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Our first story on the Fort Dodge Messenger is entitled, Winter Weather Coming Soon. Now is a good time to prepare. It's by Kelby Wingert. With today's forecast calling for sunny skies and temperatures in the upper 40s, snow and ice storms aren't on many central Iowans' minds. Still, the National Weather Service, Iowa Homeland Security, and emergency management agencies across the state want to remind Iowans of the winter weather that is just around the corner. As the length of daylight decreases and the days cool toward the winter months, it is time to ensure all Iowans have made preparations for the winter season, Andrew Ansorge, a meteorologist with the NWS in Des Moines, said in a press release for Winter Weather Awareness Day, which was Thursday. The biggest impact winter weather has on most Iowans is on the roads. According to the Iowa Department of Transportation, an average of 8,500 crashes have occurred each winter on Iowa roadways over the past 5 years. When it comes to winter travel, Iowa State Patrol Trooper Paul Gardner says, if the weather's bad, stay home. If visibility is down, there's heavy snow coming down, or the roads are icy and you don't have to go anywhere, please make it a point to stay home, he said. However, if travel is absolutely necessary, Gardner said there are some things drivers should do to be prepared for an emergency. Always make sure you have plenty of supplies with you, like food, water, plenty of warm clothing in case you're stranded, or if you crash into the ditch, he told the Messenger last fall. And always make sure your cell phone is fully charged or carry a cell phone charger to be able to call 911 or communicate with others. Unnecessary travelers on the roads during winter weather events adds to the burden of the troopers and other law enforcement and emergency service agencies. The more traffic we have out there, it ties up our resources, Gardner said. On Highway 20 or I-35, where we see a lot more traffic coming through, our resources can get utilized very quickly because we'll have jackknifed semis and cars that go in the ditch. If a vehicle does slide into a ditch, it could be a while before anyone can get there to assist, Gardner said. If the engine can still run and is being used to keep warm, he said it's important to make sure the vehicle's exhaust pipes are not blocked. After a storm, when roads are safe to travel again, it's still important for drivers to take precautions, Gardner said. Check their tires, their windshield wipers, and make sure they have a first aid kit in their vehicle in case they get stranded, he said. If people are going to be out and about, they need to make sure they're driving at a safe speed, avoid tailgating other vehicles, watch out for emergency vehicles, and most importantly, make sure they're buckled up. Gardner also noted that while most large winter storms are able to be predicted days in advance, sometimes smaller bursts of flurries or high winds aren't as predictable and can cause low visibility and slick roads. For up-to-date road conditions, including information on tow bans if the weather is really bad, the Iowa Department of Transportation has the Iowa 511 app and website 511ia.org. Next up is an article entitled New Faces Added at Growth Alliance. Ferris introduces staff. This is written by Bill Shea. New faces and some familiar people in new roles now make up the staff of the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance. Astra Ferris, who became Chief Executive Officer of the Growth Alliance in September, introduced the current staff. Jefferson Fosbender has been named Economic Development Director to replace Kelly Halstead. Emily Ayers was hired as the administrative assistant. Skyla Porter, who was the organizational administrator, was named marketing specialist. Dina McCauley, who was the office manager, has been named operations coordinator. Jill Nelson remains as community development director. Jefferson Fosbender has served the economic director for the Ackley Development Commission from May 2014 to July of 2017. He then moved into higher education, serving as a senior admissions counselor at Concordia University Chicago, and most recently as an academic assistant at Iowa Central Community College. Economic development sort of called me back in a weird sort of roundabout way, he said. Upon applying for the position, he said the team, culture, and energy of the Growth Alliance made it where it was a no-brainer. He said he found himself thinking, oh, I have to do this. Economic development work, he said, is a brand new challenge almost every single day. He said the Growth Alliance has a pipeline of about 12 projects representing millions of dollars in potential new development. Fosbender is a graduate of St. Edmund High School. He earned an associate degree from Iowa Central Community College and a bachelor's degree in business economics from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Emily Ayers, in addition to the typical administrative assistant duties, she will work with the Young Professionals Group. She's a native of Spirit Lake who graduated from Spirit Lake High School. She earned a bachelor's degree from Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and a master's degree from the University of South Dakota in Vermilion, South Dakota. I'm looking forward to meeting people, she said. New roles. In her new role, Porter will be the lead person communicating the message of the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance. Her work will include marketing, promotion, and media relations. She will also manage the annual events conducted by the Alliance. McCauley will continue her bookkeeping responsibilities, but will also oversee policies and processes. The public will have an opportunity to meet the Growth Alliance staff during an open house from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. November the 30th at the Alliance's office, 24 North 9th Street. And our final story on the front page of the Fort Dodge Messenger, one injured in rollover on Highway 20 Thursday. This is written by Kelby Wingert. A Fort Dodge man was seriously injured on Thursday morning when the semi-truck he was driving rolled after being hit by another semi on U.S. Highway 20 near Xavier Avenue in eastern Webster County. According to the crash report from the Iowa State Patrol, Martin Velasquez Trujillo of Denison was driving eastbound on Highway 20 in a 2000 Mack semi-truck when a front tire of the truck blew, causing him to lose control, crossing the median into the westbound traffic. Velasquez Trujillo's truck then struck the rear axle of a 2021 Freightliner semi driven by Richard Allen Aldrich, age 58, of Fort Dodge, causing Aldrich's truck to overturn. The accident happened about 10:25 a.m. on Thursday. According to the crash report, Aldrich sustained serious injuries and was transported by air ambulance to a medical center in Des Moines. Velasquez Trujillo was not injured in the accident. U.S. childhood vaccination exemptions reach their highest level ever. Dateline is New York on this article. The proportion of U.S. kindergartners exempted from school vaccination requirements has hit its highest level ever, 3%, U.S. health officials said Thursday. More parents are questioning routine childhood vaccinations that they use to automatically accept an effect of the political schism that emerged during the pandemic around COVID-19 vaccines, experts say. Even though more kids were given exemptions, the national vaccination rate held steady. 93% of kindergartners got their required shots for the 2022-2023 school year, the same as the year before, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention said in a report Thursday. The rate was 95% in the years before the COVID-19 pandemic. The bad news is that it's gone down since the pandemic and still hasn't rebounded, said Dr. Sean O'Leary, a University of Colorado pediatric infectious diseases specialist. The good news is that the vast majority of parents are still vaccinating their kids according to the recommended schedule. All U.S. states and territories require that children attending child care centers and schools be vaccinated against a number of diseases, including measles, mumps, polio, tetanus, whooping cough, and chickenpox. All states allow exemptions for children with medical conditions that prevent them from receiving certain vaccines, and most also permit exemptions for religious or other non-medical reasons. In the last decade, the percentage of kindergartners with medical exemptions has held steady at about 0.2%, but the percentage with non-medical exemptions has inched up, lifting the overall exemption rate from 1.6% in the 2011-2012 school year to 3% last year. Last year, more than 115,000 kindergartners were exempt from at least one vaccine, the CDC estimated. The rates vary across the country. 10 states, all in the West or Midwest, reported that more than 5% of kindergartners were exempted from at least one kind of required vaccine. Idaho had the highest percentage, with 12% of kindergartners receiving at least one exemption. In contrast, 0.1% had exemptions in New York. The rates can be influenced by state laws or policies can make it harder or easier to obtain exemptions, and by local attitudes among families and doctors about the need to get children vaccinated. Sometimes these jumps in exemptions can be very local, and it may not reflect a whole state, said O'Leary, who chairs an American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases. Hawaii saw the largest jump, with the exemption rate rising to 6.4%, nearly double the year before. Officials there said it's not due to any law or policy change. Rather, we have observed that there has been misinformation/disinformation impacting people's decision to vaccinate or not via social media platforms, officials said at the state's health department. Connecticut and Maine saw significant declines, which CDC officials attributed to recent policy changes that made it harder to get exemptions. Health officials say attaining 95% vaccination coverage is important to prevent outbreaks of preventable diseases, especially of measles, which is extremely contagious. The U.S. has seen measles outbreaks begin when travelers infected elsewhere came to communities with low vaccination rates. That happened in the year 2019 when about 1,300 measles cases were reported, the most in the U.S. in nearly 30 years. Most of the cases were in Orthodox Jewish communities with low vaccination rates. One apparent paradox in the report, the national vaccination rate held steady even as exemptions increased. How could that be? CDC officials say it's because there are actually three groups of children in the vaccination statistics. One is those who get all the shots. A second is those who get exemptions. The third are children who didn't seek exemptions but also didn't get all their shots and paperwork completed at the time the data was collected. Last year, those kids in that third group probably decreased, offsetting the increase in the exemption group, the CDC's Shannon Stokely said. Now here's the Messenger editorial. It's entitled, Americans Unite Behind Veterans. It is time to thank those who make our liberties possible. How fortuitous it is that while the attention of millions of Americans seems focused on controversy, we take time out to honor those about whom we are in complete agreement, veterans of military service. No matter how we view politics, we are united in revering the men and women who have served and do serve us in uniform. The Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and now Space Force are the solid wall behind which our freedoms rest. They serve us not as Democrats, Republicans, Independents, or adherents to any particular political philosophy. They serve us simply as Americans. It is their steadfast, pure patriotism that we celebrate on Veterans Day. Veterans Day is Saturday, but Fort Dodge and many other communities are honoring their veterans with observations today. Even during peacetime, the veterans make enormous sacrifices for us. In effect, they take years off from their lives to go where they are asked to go and do what they are asked to do. Sometimes that takes them to foreign lands. Sometimes it places them aboard ships on lengthy cruises. Sometimes it means their posts are right here in the United States, but far from their homes. Families, friends, old classmates, and former co-workers are seen only frequently. Their families become their brothers and sisters in arms. Because the military must be on guard constantly, the jobs they do come with inherent risk. The regularity of reports that servicemen and women are killed or injured in training accidents or even during the course of normal duties reminds us of that. During times of conflict, be they full-scale wars or armed confrontations that may not even make news, of course, everything changes. It is then that our foes learn invariably why the American military is respected and usually feared throughout the world. And it is then that we, whose liberties are being safeguarded, are reminded just how important our men and women in uniform are to us. Expressing our gratitude to them grows more important by the day. Now we do just that. We honor and thank from the bottoms of our hearts those who served and have served. And this Veterans Day, we pray that God will watch over and keep them with the same kind of steadfastness they showed for us. This month's Spotlight article is entitled Blinded in Vietnam, Doug Slotin Led Life of Strength, Courage, and Accomplishment. It's written by Paul Stevens. Was the remarkable life of Doug Slotin a matter of destiny or the random nature of life? Like the feather that floats on a breeze in the movie Forrest Gump, prompting Forrest to observe, I don't know if we each have a destiny or if we are all just floating around accidental-like on a breeze, but I think maybe it's both. Doug Slotin's feather lifted him from his parents' farm home in Barnum to the University of Iowa to the financial district of Chicago to the battlefields of Vietnam, where he lost his eyesight and half of his right leg, to law school at Arizona State University, to a job with the federal government in Washington, D.C., and one day in the near future to his burial at Arlington National Cemetery. Slotin died September the 29th of prostate cancer under hospice care at his home in Chevy Chase, Maryland, surrounded by family, his wife Elin, twin daughters Chelsea and Kirsten, sister Deanna and Nancy, and brother Lyle. He was age 76. Less than a month after his death, the circle of life and Doug's first name continued with the birth of the first grandchild for Elin and Doug, Maxwell Douglas Pavlovic, born on October the 24th in San Francisco, California, to daughter Kirsten and her husband Alex. "I think my dad would be super happy and proud," Kirsten said. "Max has his chin and mine, and also his furrowed brow when he's thinking really hard or displeased by something." It was a December day in 1970 when Army Sergeant Douglas Slotin stepped on a landmine while on a reconnaissance patrol in South Vietnam, attached to the 101st Airborne Division. He was quickly evacuated to a hospital ship, but doctors were unable to save his sight and were forced to amputate the lower half of his right leg. Call it his destiny or the random nature of life, this much is true. The injuries changed the course of Slotin's life and all the lives he touched for the next 53 years. Slotin, a recipient of the Purple Heart, set out with resolve and courage on a future far removed from the farm where he grew up, a future that took him as a blind amputee to law school in Arizona, an impactful 45-year career with the Federal Communications Commission in the nation's capital, and a marriage that in its 37 years produced twin daughters and a grandson who bears his name. Slotin will be buried at Arlington National Cemetery with a memorial stone in Iowa. Because of a backlog of burials at Arlington, his family expects it could take at least a year, but plans to hold two memorial services, one in early 2024 at Christ Episcopal Church in Kensington, Maryland, and the other at the church of his childhood, Fulton Lutheran Church of Roland. Heroes are buried at Arlington, and Slotin was a hero, but a larger way than what happened to him in Vietnam. "While many may see Douglas as a war hero, I see him as a life hero," said his sister Deanna. "What makes him so special is not what happened to him in war, but rather what he did after that and how he did it. He was not bitter, didn't feel sorry for himself. Instead, he set about figuring out how to continue with the dreams he had and then pursued them with tenacity and great success. He truly overcame so many obstacles that would have given most people pause, but remained ever humble and grateful for the life he had." The arrival of Veterans Day 2023 sparked a memory from daughter Chelsea. "He used to come in our school classrooms to talk on Veterans Day on what he did in the Vietnam War," she said. "One of the stories he would tell was being on a hospital ship after he was injured and an Army chaplain coming in to talk to him. The chaplain had a bit of a prepared speech on the meaning of life and such and started in on the speech. My dad interrupted and said, 'You're wasting your time. A lot of people say that. You don't understand. I was lucky enough to be born in a free country. This was my price that I'm willing to pay so that my family can live in a free country.' I don't know if it ever occurred to him to feel bad or resentful. He didn't let it define his life or purpose." Douglas Lee Slotin's roots trace to a farmland in Roland. He was born in Fort Dodge on December 22, 1946, to Leo Russell Slotin and Evelyn Woods Slotin. He was the oldest of four children, including sisters Deanna Reefsteck and Elysian of Elysian, Minnesota, and Nancy Randolph of Garden City, Kansas, and brother Lyle Slotin of San Bernardino, California. Their maternal grandparents, Nellie and Lewis Woods, lived in Fort Dodge until their deaths. Their aunt, Betty Slotin, is a Fort Dodge resident. When the family moved to another farm in Barnum, Doug committed to Cedar Valley High School in Summers for his senior year and graduated in 1965. His siblings graduated from Northwest Webster High School. A classmate of Doug's at Cedar Valley, Daryl Beal of Fort Dodge, said, "His classmates respected and admired him, but he made us feel a bit inadequate. He accomplished so much blind and with an artificial leg. Doug's life and death and legacy reminds that our days are numbered. We must celebrate every day we have on this earth." Slotin attended the University of Iowa in Iowa City and received a bachelor's degree in accounting in 1969. Friends say his propensity at poker and ironing shirts for fellow students helped finance his education. He remained a dedicated Hawkeye sports fan, especially basketball, for the rest of his life. His first job out of Iowa City was in Chicago with a major accounting firm, Ernst & Young, now known as Ernst & Young, but his employment was brief when he was drafted in August of 1969. It was at Fort Des Moines where he met Paul Onerheim of Ottumwa, who would become a lifelong friend. Together, they attended Army basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and then advanced infantry training. Slotin was promoted to Sergeant E5, and after assignments in Georgia and Kansas, got his orders for Vietnam. He shipped out on November the 7th, 1970. 5 weeks into Vietnam, he was with a reconnaissance platoon on December the 14th of 1970, assigned to the 101st Airborne Division that was landed by helicopter on a hilltop in hazardous territory north of Hue. "We were checking the area," he recalled in a 1971 interview with the Des Moines Tribune. "I went off to one side looking for signs of the enemy. Our group had found one mine. I found the second. I stepped on it." Within an hour, he was flown in a military helicopter to the USS Sanctuary, a Navy hospital ship, where he stayed 17 days. After spending New Year's Eve at the Da Nang Airport, he was flown to Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. He was given home leave and returned to Iowa with crutches and a wheelchair. "It was a happy time and it was a hard time," Slotin told Lois Johnson of The Messenger on a November 5, 1971 interview. "It was harder for the folks than for me. I'd had a month to adjust. They hadn't. I had ideas about how to function. They had to learn." He came to Fort Dodge during the week and stayed with his grandparents and walked daily from their home at 4 Johnson Place to downtown. "In this way," he told The Messenger, "I can find out how people react to me. I get out and visit, mingle with people, go into stores and buy things, and order meals in restaurants by myself. My success in these experiences will help decide my future." Slotin returned to Walter Reed, where he learned to read Braille, and then entered Heinz Veterans Hospital in Chicago for intensive training in how to live as a blind person and how to walk with an artificial leg. He returned to the University of Iowa as a special student and took 3 courses and, remarkably, as a blind student, completed the 4th and final section of the Certified Public Accountant test, one he had failed earlier when sighted. Slotin decided to pursue an earlier ambition of entering law school. He applied and was admitted to Arizona State University School of Law, becoming the first totally blind person to enter the law school. With a Braille typewriter and several tape recorders and living alone in a student-filled apartment complex in Tempe, he graduated cum laude in August of 1975 joined the Federal Communications Commission as an attorney and made the move to Washington, where he would live the rest of his life. 3 years later, he was named Outstanding Handicapped Federal Employee of the Year. He commuted to work by bus and train for most of his career before taking cabs and Ubers in his later years. He retired in the year 2021. Shirley and her husband, Jack, established their home and raised their family in Fort Dodge, Iowa. Upon retirement, they moved to Hendersonville, North Carolina, and spent 19 years in a home nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Their final move was to Durham, North Carolina, to be nearer to their family. The family will hold a private ceremony at a later date, along with an interment at the Western Carolina State Veterans Cemetery in Black Mountain, North Carolina. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to the American Cancer Society or to a charity of one's choice in memory of Shirley. Cindy Elliott, age 73, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Wednesday, November 8, 2023, at Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Funeral services will be held on Tuesday, November 14th at 10:30 a.m. at Prince of Peace Lutheran Church. Burial will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be on Monday from 4 to 7 p.m. at Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Geraldine Schultz Peterson, age 95, of Lawrence, passed away on Wednesday, November the 8th at the Pocahontas Community Hospital in Pocahontas, Iowa. Funeral service is 10:30 a.m. Monday, November the 13th at Powers Funeral Home, Sacred Heart Chapel in Lawrence, Iowa, with Reverend Deb Parkinson officiating. Burial will take place in Washington Cemetery near Havelock, Iowa. Visitation is from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 12th, at the funeral home in Lawrence. Patricia Sue Zika, age 73, of Fort Dodge, passed away a broken heart on Tuesday, November the 7th, at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 15th, at St. Olaf Lutheran Church. Burial will follow in Memorial Park Cemetery. A visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday in the chapel of Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Eric Rick Gambill, Sr., age 66, of Lehigh, passed away on November 8, 2023, at his home in Lehigh. A family graveside service will be held at a later date. Arrangements are with Historic Buse Funeral Home of Fort Dodge. To view the complete obituary and leave online condolences for the family, please visit www.brucesfuneralhome.com. And unfortunately, that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger. Earlier, you heard the Mason City Globe Gazette. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.